So today I would like to discuss one more advanced topic in Hamiltonian mechanics, and that is of constraints. So bar F will be constraints. And so what I will mostly mention will be very, very confusing, but hopefully it will apparent more, it will be more clear after you do today's tutorial. So you are trying to solve a situation that sometimes actually not all the coordinates in the phase space are indeed independent. Okay, so you are trying to solve a situation where let not all qi and pi, so not all the coordinates on the phase space, be independent. So what I mean by that is that at any instant of time, that is at any instant of time, they are somehow related, instant of time. We have a constraint. A constraint which you can write as some function of this qi and pi equals to zero. Okay, so you find that, for example, x square plus y square equals to l square for a pendulum, and so then you know that x and y are not really independent because they are related by a constant. Okay, so that would be an example of a constraint. So now you can have many various constraints, and it's a whole science, and you can read about this, for example, in Dirac's book. So there's this very thin, not even 100 pages thick book by Dirac, and I don't know how it's called, Lectures on Quantum Mechanics or something like that, probably. And so he basically develops the whole theory, you know, how you classify constraints, why do you need constraints, what to do with constraints and stuff like that. So if you are interested, read that book. So for us, I'll just take the simplest possible constraints ever, and I'll just deal with them in the simplest possible way. Okay. So now, let me just make a remark. And so it might be already obvious, but it will be definitely obvious from the geometric interpretation, which we'll do in a minute. Mark. So you can basically use any phase space function as a Hamiltonian. Okay, so we will see today that if you define any phase space function, you can associate with it the corresponding vector field in the phase space. And that vector field, of course, has its integral lines, and you can move along these integral lines in the phase space. Okay, so you can sort of define a preferred direction determined by this phase space function f. Okay, and so in particular, if you just call that function f a Hamiltonian, you will call that direction time evolution. But this is just, you know, a preferred choice of your function f, then you say this is the Hamiltonian. But any function can, in principle, be Hamiltonian. So any phase space function f can be understood as Hamiltonian and generates the corresponding flow . And so you can even assign this flow some fictitious time, which you would call t of f, okay? And so then you would have time evolution, which would be, so for example, for coordinates, but for any functions, property of the corresponding function f. So how my coordinate evolves under this flow generated by the function f. And it's simply given by the Poisson bracket, where I treat this f as a Hamiltonian. So this is something like my Hamiltonian. Okay? And now I'm throwing away the explicit time dependence here. And so, of course, the same will be for p. dpi over dtf is just pi on f. So these are just basically your canonical equations, if you want, where now I'm just saying, well, f is basically a Hamiltonian. OK, so for any function, we have the corresponding flow. OK, so now if you have an integral of motion or a conserved quantity, so specifically, we have conserved quantity. So now this is, well, I denoted conserved quantities by I, but it's just a special example of this space-based function f, right? So I depends on q and p. It's an integral of motion, so it's some special example of a space-based function. However, this conserved quantity is defined by the fact that I said, well, it's something which commutes with the Hamiltonian. Of course, okay, so this is the definition that under the time evolution generated by Hamiltonian, that conserved quantity does not change. Okay, so as I evolve in time, I still carry the same energy. Okay, so this guy is equal to zero. But of course, the Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric. Okay, so you can write this as h and I as well. Okay, what a surprising identity here. However, now I can interpret this relation. So this is still equal to zero, of course. But now I can say, well, I have some time evolution, so I associate t of I. And so I'm interested how the Hamiltonian changes under this time evolution generated by this conserved quantity I. And of course, this is equal to zero. So you see that actually this flow generated by a conserved leaves the leaves the Hamiltonian invariant. Okay, so this means that Hamiltonian is invariant under the flow generated by I. Okay, so it's just this anti-symmetric property here, which has, you know, far-reaching consequences. And so you can understand it either that the time evolution of the quantity I is equal to zero, so that I is conserved, or actually the time evolution generated by I leaves the Hamiltonian invariant. So now you have some kind of transformation which you can do on your phase space so that the Hamiltonian is invariant. Of course, this is the definition of the symmetry. So symmetry is something that, you know, I can do something with the phase space or with the configuration space earlier on, which leaves the dynamics untouched. Okay, so this is basically exactly the definition of the symmetry. Okay, so now look at this beautiful thing. So of course, as I defined my constraints, so the constraint is something which is true in all times. So so it is a conserved quantity in some sense. So the constraint is at any instant of time, this is still equal to zero. Okay, so constraints are special examples, if you want. So constraints are special conserved quantities and as such, they define the symmetry of the problem. So So they define a symmetry by this argument here. So in other words, yeah. Is this clear? So whenever you have constraint, you have extra symmetry in your phase space. Okay, so that's the first remark. So now let me just draw this very, very standard example of what's happening when you have constraints in the simplest possible way. So standard example, of course, that will be that of the pendulum. So we have pendulum here. And so I have a ball hanging on a rope. This is in the gravitational field. And the ball does this swing here. And so the standard way how to describe the system in the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian mechanics is just you are clever enough. And you say, well, this is truly a system with 1 degree of freedom. I can choose this degree of freedom to be the angle phi. And so in this description, we have really n equals to 1 numbers of degrees of freedom. The corresponding phase space, of course, is two-dimensional. So we have phi. We have phi, and then p phi is the corresponding momentum. So let's say the length of this thing is L, doesn't matter, it's just constant. So and so there's no constraint. Okay. So this is the clever description. Clever description or maybe you have heard this saying Occam's razor. So it's like a principle of Occam's razor means that you should really be clever enough and describe the system as simple as possible. So never more in a more complicated way. So here really we were clever to describe by this angle phi. And so although it seems that the motion is sort of two-dimensional, in fact it's actually only one-dimensional. I can choose this phi here. Okay, so it's clever description due to Occam. Let me just mention this name. You can look it up in the Wikipedia. Okay. So now this is one way to describe the system. So now you want to compare this with another description where you actually write it as a two-dimensional system. Constraint description. So in this case, of course, it's exactly the same system. I have my ball here. But now I use two coordinates, x and y. So this, let's say, is x. And this is my y coordinate. Of course, this is the original phi here. So I'm describing the system in terms of coordinates x and y. Now in this case, it seems like I have 2 degrees of freedom. Okay. So the corresponding phase space will be four-dimensional. So it will be x, y, px, and py. So I have now 4 quantities here. But of course, x and y are not completely independent. They have to satisfy that x squared plus y squared equals to l squared all the time. Okay, so now we have a constraint. Constraint, which is that phi equals to x squared plus y squared minus l squared equals to 0. Okay, so this is your constraint phi. So now, of course, you can remove that constraint by going to that angle phi. So you can, if you have the constraint, you can remove it by saying that, so eliminate constraint, need constraint by saying, well, by introducing phi. So x is L times cosine phi, and y is L times sine phi. And that will completely eliminate the constraint, so you can return back to that description here. Okay? So it almost seems that this thing is really, really stupid to do, because if you are clever enough, you can do the left description, everything is more simple. However, sometimes this constraint description has advantages. And so let me just mention two. So advantage of this description So one of them is obvious for what I was saying here. So we have now constraint. That means we have now extra symmetry in the spacetime. So we have, well, in the description, so extra symmetry. Okay. Because we have the constraint. So a more practical thing is that sometimes people are not only interested where the ball is as it evolves in time, but for example, what the force on what the tension of the string which is holding the ball actually is. Okay, so there will be some kind of tension here. So actually can calculate the constraint force of constraint. And I'm sure you have done that in your undergraduate courses. And so in particular, you can calculate the tension of the string S function of string T. So really you can calculate, you know, how much you have to hold the how strongly you have to hold that string at each instant of time in some sense. Okay, so if you use this constraint description, there is a procedure how you can calculate this T as well. Okay, are there questions to this? So you have sort of two equivalent descriptions, but they are not completely equivalent. Of course, the right one is more complicated, but also you can learn more. Okay, so now interestingly, when people study various theories or whatever, it's sometimes advantageous to go to this constraint description, because of the first reason, because you are getting extra symmetry. Okay? So for example, you can describe gravity, and you know there is a diffeomorphism invariance, or you don't know. But there are other descriptions of gravity. You put some Weyl square terms and whatever. And so you enlarge the phase space, so now you will have extra fields there, you will have some scalar field and whatever. But you are getting an extra symmetry, which is the Weyl symmetry, which is the conformally scaling symmetry, if you want. And so sometimes, you know, the extra symmetry is very, very powerful. So although the theory looks more complicated, you are choosing larger phase space, then the extra symmetry is very, very useful for finding the solutions or whatever. Okay, so sometimes this description is actually quite nice description. Okay, so now, so it's just an example. So now I will not derive it, but you can look it up in any textbook, or you can look up the Wikipedia. So to deal with constraints, one uses a method of Lagrange multipliers. Method of Lagrange multipliers. So, in particular, if you have M constraints, so J goes from 1 to m are my constraints, then the prescription, and you can do it in Hamiltonian or Lagrangian, prescription doesn't matter, so let me do the Hamiltonian, is the same thing. So So the prescription is, let's, if you have these constraints, it's not enough to consider the Hamiltonian as you know it, but actually you have to add, you have to sum over all constraints and add it to the Hamiltonian. So then consider the so-called total Hamiltonian, H total, which is the Hamiltonian as you would write it if you had no constraints, and then you sum over all these constraints, J to 1 to M, lambda J, this depends on T, and then phi J. Capital J, okay? So the prescription is, let's form this total Hamiltonian, and let's study dynamics not with the original one, but with this total one, okay? So now these lambda JT are called Lagrange multipliers, and they are arbitrary functions of time. And so now, okay, so that's the prescription. So if you have constraints in the system, just add them to your Hamiltonian, and now deal with this Hamiltonian as if it described your system. Okay? However, you can have two possibilities now. So now, in undergraduate courses, probably the first possibility is used. But I want to mention the second one as well. So now, two possibilities. So the first one is that you say, and this is done in undergraduate courses, is you say, well, I have enlarged my Hamiltonian. Why don't I enlarge the phase space as well? Okay, so first possibility is enlarge phase space even further. And this is done by saying that these Lagrange multipliers are actually my new coordinates in that phase space. Okay, so I would have P lambda, but obviously P lambda does not occur in this total Hamiltonian, but I have some new coordinates, so apart from QJ, I have these lambda J coordinates as well, and so I will have the corresponding enlarged phase space. So consider lambda J T as new coordinates. So if you do that, then you can write down the Euler-Lagrange equations or Hamilton's equations, doesn't matter. But now considering that now it's not only Q, but also lambda. So you have to vary with respect to lambda as well. Okay, so that means I have to vary problem with respect to lambda j as well. So if you do the Lagrangian description, that means that you in fact get n, the numbers of degrees of freedom for q, but also I have these m new coordinates, so you'll have n plus m Euler Lagrange equations. These n plus m Euler Lagrange equations, of course, are Euler Lagrange equations for q and for lambda. Those for lambda are very, very simple. If you vary the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian with respect to lambda, all it does is just brings down the constraint. So m of these, so the simplest one you return back to m of those, so j to 1 to m are m Euler-Lagrange equations, and then you have some modified Euler-Lagrange equations for q, where the phi also enters into that, okay? Plus n modified Euler-Lagrange equations for qj. Okay, so you have now n plus m Euler-Lagrange equations, but at the same time you have n plus m unknowns, so you can actually use these constraints and eliminate everything and solve it. And this is typically done in the undergraduate courses. So this you probably have seen. Okay, so you are really, and when you are solving these equations, you are really using these constraints. You know that this is equal to zero, and you can differentiate it. It will still be equal to zero. You plug it back to Euler-Lagrange equations, the other ones, and you solve it in the end. Okay, so this is typically done in undergraduate courses. There is, however, much more subtle and interesting possibility, which people typically use when they discuss field theories. And so that is, you are not enlarging phase space, and you just treat these as arbitrary functions. Okay, they are not your new coordinates, they are just arbitrary functions. So keep lambda j of t as arbitrary functions. So then, of course, you have only n Euler-Lagrange equations for qj of t. But of course, these Euler-Lagrange equations will depend on lambdas. Okay, so the lambdas, you cannot make them disappear. So now, which depend on lambda j of t. Okay, so lambda j of t is some arbitrary functions. I just vary with respect to q, this Hamiltonian. I get n Euler-Lagrange equations, but the lambdas are still there. Okay, so as a consequence, because the lambdas are there, so let me just do one lambda and the picture. So as a consequence, the time evolution is not unique because it depends on this arbitrary lambda. So time evolution not unique. In fact, if you start with some initial data, I start here with q0 and p0, and then I choose one lambda, I go over here. So this is, I don't know, well, one lambda I choose. But if I choose different lambda, I will actually appear here. Okay, so this is, I choose lambda tilde or whatever. And if I choose different lambda, I'll appear here. Okay, so the time evolution is not unique, and so provided the initial data q0 and p0, I end up, you know, in different places on the phase space, depending on what I choose as my lambda. So now, is this a disaster or not? Of course, it's not a disaster, because all these points, you can connect them. Okay, you can connect them. And so the statement is that there will be a flow going from one point to another point to another point. This is precisely that point, flow generated by a constraint. Okay, this is the flow generated by constraint. Okay, and so you know that flow actually doesn't do anything with the dynamics. So what you have done here is that you have chosen a description which doesn't have a unique time evolution, but the final endpoints of your time evolution are equivalent. They mean the same physical thing. So all these things, so all the points, all the endpoints, points are physically equivalent. And they are precisely related by that extra symmetry which you have due to the presence of the constraint, are physically equivalent related by the symmetry. So it seems It's a complete disaster. I ended up here or I ended up there, but it's actually not true. It just tells you, well, I have some extra symmetry, which tells me actually here and there are the same points. They are the same physical things. Okay? So this is the second point of view, how you can look at the constraints. And this is the one used in field theory, typically. Okay? So now you really keep all these lambdas there. You have non-unique solution of your equations of motion. So now the Q of t will depend on these lambdas. But you have an extra symmetry, which tells you no matter whatever lambda I choose, actually the results are equivalent, and they describe the same physical situation. And you will study this in the tutorial today. So let me just mention final point. So is this clear? Does it make sense? Maybe it's not clear, but maybe it makes a little bit sense. OK, so one remark, which I want to say is that one source of constraints, which typically happens, is precisely that Legendre transformation. If you start with the system described by Lagrangian formulation and you want to formulate a Hamiltonian formulation, then actually it happens that for certain systems, you get constraints automatically out of that. So one source of constraints is indeed going from is a Legendre transformation. As you go from the Lagrangian description to the Hamiltonian description. So in particular, what I assumed before is that we started the Hamiltonian description by saying we can define dl over dqi dot, and this is my new canonical momentum. And so in order to write the Hamiltonian, we had to invert this. And you have to write qi dot as a function of qj, p, and t. Okay, so this you had to write down this inversion, and then you could formulate the Hamiltonian, right? So the prescription is take pq dot minus l, but then plug everywhere where you see q dot, plug it in terms of q and p. So now the problem is that this inversion may not exist. And if it doesn't exist, typically you pick up a constraint. Okay? So in fact, you can show by studying the following matrix. So in fact, you can compose the corresponding matrix. Let's call it Aij, which is d square l dqi dot dqj dot. Okay, so the prescription is let's take this matrix and study its eigenvalues. So if it has zero eigenvalues, you are in trouble. This inversion will not always exist. And you can show that in that case, the qi dot is actually written as qi dot is written as q, p, but also lambda and t. Well, lambda is an arbitrary function. So in this case, if this matrix here is degenerate, if it has some zero eigenvalues, then you can show that this inversion may depend on arbitrary functions. And you have that many functions as the number of zero eigenvalues for this matrix. So j, so again, runs from 1 to m, where m is the number of zero value eigenvalues. OK, so if this matrix has 2, then you get 2 Lagrange multipliers, basically. And so your q dot depends on these arbitrary 2 Lagrange multipliers. So this is a typical origin of constraints. For example, if you start with the Lagrangian description and you go to the Hamiltonian one, it may not be so easy. OK? So oh no, I spent twice as much time as I wanted on this. But anyway, so what you will do in your tutorial is a very, very interesting example. So toy example. So you will consider just motion of a free particle. Okay? So motion of free particle. Well, you say, well, this is nothing interesting about free particle. Of course, your Lagrangian is just written as 1/2 m x dot square. Okay. Well, this is only true if you use nice and inertial time, t. Okay. So now imagine that you want to describe the same system with a broken watch. So for example, you swim in the sea. And your watch is broken, and sometimes it goes faster, sometimes it goes slower. And so the question is, can you still describe the dynamics of the system using this crazy time? So motion of the free particle, but using lousy time. So basically, you are saying that now I have new time, probably different notation than in the tutorial. Doesn't matter, is that this is some arbitrary function of my inertial time. Okay? So the question is, can you still do this? And so what you will find, so I'll tell you to go to the Hamiltonian description and describe the system using this lousy time. But what you will find is actually that if you go from L to H, you will find a crazy thing is that h is actually equal to 0. So basically, because you have now completely lousy time, the time shows you anything you want, there is no dynamics with respect to the standard Hamiltonian. However, you will find a constraint and so then the total Hamiltonian, of course, is non-trivial. Okay, so the whole H total is now actually lambda of t times that constraint. And so the total Hamiltonian actually generates some kind of dynamics. And if you are clever enough, actually you can recognize the standard dynamics of the free particle from there. Okay, so I think this is a beautiful example how you can be really confused about things. By the way, if you use lousy time, you actually not only enlarge your phase space, because now you have to consider how the inertial time looks like in terms of your lousy time, but also how x looks like in terms of your lousy time. So now you have enlarged phase space. You have extra constraint, but because you have enlarged phase space and constraint, you have extra symmetry. So actually, this thing will be very, very symmetric and nice. Okay, you will see in that. So by the way, this is a very typical situation that h equals to 0 in the gauge theories. And you will see the Hamiltonian of the gravity is equal to 0. And so systems which have h equal to 0 are called totally constrained systems. Constrained system. This is an example of that. Really, really toy example about gravity would be another one. And it's related to this diffeomorphism invariance or whatever. So I think this example teaches you a lot. And yeah. And you can study it both ways. You can study it either the first way, or you can study it the second way, whatever. OK? Are there any questions? Constraints? Yes?
Lousy time, how exactly?
Huh?
Lousy time is like.
So I'm saying, you know, your watch can sometimes go very fast, sometimes very slow. It's, you know, this basically, it's an arbitrary function of the inertial time. That's what I mean by that. Other questions? Okay, so I spent 30 minutes more than I wanted on constraints. So now, in the rest of today's lecture and in tomorrow's lecture, I would like to show you this beautiful geometric description of Hamiltonian mechanics. And for that, you can either use the symplectic geometry or you can use the so-called contact geometry. So now the contact geometry is in some sense more powerful because it allows also for time-dependent Hamiltonians, but it's also less familiar and people don't like it that much. So I will just do the symplectic geometry description, which is the standard one. And then if you are interested, you can read about the contact geometry description in the notes. Although the contact geometry is actually more general, in some sense. It's nicer and more general. But anyway, so now this is chapter 4, geometric formulation. Formulation of Hamiltonian mechanics. And then let me start with part A, which will be the symplectic geometry. And so just a warning, so this will work only for autonomous systems. So for works for autonomous systems that means that the Hamiltonian is not a function of time explicitly. Okay, so most of the systems are autonomous. So typically, I don't know, if you consider harmonic oscillator, it doesn't depend explicitly on time, the Hamiltonian. No, most of the systems don't. So that's why the symplectic geometry is enough for most of the system. Okay, so now definition. And so now if you have reviewed the differential geometry from before, so then you say, well, so assumption is let an even dimensional manifold, which has the dimension 2n, and let's call it M, be an even dimensional manifold then you say a symplectic structure on this manifold symplectic structure on M is closed non-degenerate 2 form. Is closed and non-degenerate 2 form omega. Okay? So this is a symplectic structure. So what I mean by closed, of course, it means it's closed. So closed means that if I do the exterior derivative on my 2 form, I get 0. So that's what closed means. So this is a 2 form, so it has 2 indices, omega, alpha, beta. They are antisymmetric, that means it's a 2 form. Okay, it's a 2 tensor, which is completely antisymmetric. So it's a 2 form. And it's closed, so d omega equals to 0. And it's non-degenerate, meaning that basically if I imagine this omega alpha beta as a matrix, it will have no zero eigenvalues. Okay, so it will have non-trivial eigenvalues. So we can write it in, you know, in a fancy notation. Non-degenerate basically means that if you take any vector x, which is non-trivial, then there exists, for any vector x, there exists a vector y, so that omega x and y is not equal to 0. Okay? So that's a fancy way how to write it. That is non-degenerate. What it practically means is that if you write it as a matrix, it has the full rank. Okay? So this is what you call, so now you have a manifold which is And on that manifold, there lives this two-form omega. And it's a very, very special two-form omega. And if you have that, you call that a symplectic structure. And the pair M, the pair M2N and omega is called symplectic manifold. Okay, so just a definition. So far, nothing really difficult, right? It's just a definition. Okay. So now what is nice is that once you have this symplectic structure, you don't really have to distinguish vectors from covectors. Okay? So that was precisely Samantha's question. So they look very much the same, but of course they are not the same because they live in different space. So one of them, they have indices up, one of them, they have indices down. In general, there is no way how you can map one index to the other. Okay, but otherwise, they look very much alike, like, you know, the same vector space, well, almost the same vector space, and so on. So now, if you have additional structures on your manifold, you actually don't have to distinguish them really too much, because you can map one to the other. And so this is precisely what happens in the case of metric, but also in the case of when you have omega. Okay, so how you do this? So first, you define another object, which is called capital omega, as an inverse of small omega. As an inverse of small omega. So then I'll have so in components, my omega, capital omega will have indices up or whatever. And then this is my original omega. And so this is a matrix. This is a matrix. This is a matrix multiplication. So you have to get one in order this to be inverse to that. Okay. So this is delta, alpha, gamma. So you define capital omega by this relation here. And of course, you know that if you know the matrix and the matrix is non-degenerate, then the inverse is also it's uniquely defined. OK, so omega is uniquely defined. Because this guy is non-degenerate. Okay, so that's the first thing. So now we have two objects, actually. Both of them are non-degenerate. So now you can use omega and capital omega to map vectors to covectors and so on. So for example, so this allows to identify vectors with covectors and so on. And so in this case, Samantha, you don't really need to distinguish the two. Okay, so that was a good question. So now omega really maps the tangent bundle of M to the cotangent bundle of M. So in components, I take a vector V alpha in the tangent space. And then all I do is that I map it to a covector V beta, which is given by V alpha omega alpha beta. Okay, so you can, to any vector in the tangent space, you can assign the corresponding covector by simply using small omega. And I just contract over the two indices here. I get a new thing here, which has index down. OK, so similarly, capital omega goes the other way around. So it goes t star of m to t of m. And so if you take a one form eta alpha, then you assign a vector eta beta, which is now given by omega beta alpha eta alpha. OK, so this is precisely as you would do it if you had the metric in special relativity or whatever. However, what is the betrayal here is that the metric is symmetric, so it doesn't matter over which index you really contract. But these objects are anti-symmetric. They are, so this guy is a form. So it really matters if I contract with the first index or if I contract with the second index, they differ by sign. Right? So you have to be careful which index you are contracting. And it's in this case, when you are lowering index, is the first one. And if you are rising the index, is the second one. Otherwise, you pick up a minus sign. OK? So in the presence of symplectic form, you actually don't have to distinguish forms from vectors, really. Questions? Yes?
So without the symplectic structure, why couldn't you map from vectors to covectors just by replacing partial x mu with dx mu?
Well, OK, you could do that. But it's not. Well, the only connection, if you don't have extra structure there, is you know that how one basis is related to the other. So this, the definition, so dx mu acting on d over dx nu is delta mu nu. So then you know how these spaces, the basis in the two spaces are connected. But there's really no way how you map the object from one space to the other space, right? So you cannot say I have, I don't know how to do that.
Why is my map not a good map, where you just replace the basis vector with the corresponding basis vector?
Finding the map, right? In order to
know
what does that map?
I don't know. It seems like a natural map.
Okay. So my statement, yeah.
That's more or less what this is doing. This is defining your map.
Some extra scaling.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I don't know. I don't have the right answer. Okay. So we can do this map here. So now something which I told you already today is that for any phase space function, you can define the corresponding vector field, and you can also define the corresponding integral curves. So given a function f on M, omega defines the corresponding vector field, which is called Hamiltonian vector field, a Hamiltonian vector field. You would really have to know how to map the components from one to the other, right? And So if you say I am taking the same thing, you are basically using the metric in some sense. You are using the Riemannian metric where you say I'm lowering the index by taking the same index in the other basis. So that's lowering by a metric which is a trivial metric. Yeah. Okay. So for any function f, we define the corresponding vector field, which is called x of f. And it's simply defined by omega dot df. So what does it mean? So this is a one form. This is something which eats one forms and produces a vector. OK, so in components, x of f alpha is just omega alpha beta, and then d beta of f. So this is the same thing. So you define a vector field through this omega thing. Of course, this is nothing else. And you can equivalently write this as xf hook small omega equals to minus df. So the same thing. So you can either use big omega and put df on that side, or this must be true. So let me show that they are really the same thing. So what is written here is x alpha omega alpha gamma. So that's the left-hand side here. Okay, so now you want to write a unity here. Or, okay, so why don't I use this thing here? So why don't I use omega df? So x alpha is nothing else than omega alpha beta d beta f, and then omega alpha gamma. Okay, so I use for x alpha this definition here, or this one here. But now you notice that you have this thing and that thing. Okay, so now it almost looks like a definition of what you mean by capital omega by this inversion. So this is something like delta beta gamma, but you are summing over the other index. So you pick up a minus sign. So this thing is minus delta beta gamma, and the minus comes from the fact that this alpha here is not the second one, it's the first one. Okay, so now this is minus d gamma of f, which is precisely this in components. Okay, so that's the proof.
Can you say that again?
Okay, so what I'm trying to say is that you can define the vector field here, and the vector field immediately will satisfy this relation here. Okay, or you can use this as a definition, and then you'll see that this is implied. So okay, so what I'm doing here? So I'm writing the left-hand side here in the components, which is x alpha f omega alpha gamma. Okay, so that's in the components. So now I'm plugging the definition of what I mean by x alpha here. So I have omega alpha beta d beta alpha. So this is x alpha, and then I still have omega alpha gamma from here. Okay, so now I look at this term and that term. So you have omega alpha beta omega alpha gamma, which is minus omega beta alpha omega alpha gamma because of the antisymmetry of capital omega in the two indices. So if I swap the two indices, I pick up a minus sign. And this is precisely the definition of capital omega. So it gives me the Kronecker delta, but with this minus sign. So now I plug it here, and you find the last relation. Does it answer the question?
I don't know why you have to switch the indices on the first one in order to get the definition. Where is that?
Oh, well, you can, right? You don't have to, but sorry?
Is it because the second index on the top has to match the?
Yeah, because I want to use this relation here. I want to use this relation here. And this will be only true if I sum over the second index and the first index. So if the betas are next to each other, it will work only that. If they are not, then I don't know what to do. So I'm transforming that into that situation. OK, so we have the corresponding vector field. And that vector field, of course, will also generate the corresponding integral curves, and these integral curves to generate the corresponding flow in the phase space. All right, so we have that. So now, an important theorem is that the vector field is actually nice. Okay, so the Hamiltonian vector fields, which means vector fields which are generated by functions on the phase space, they behave nicely with respect to this omega. So they are sort of defined through this omega, and so that's why they leave invariant omega. So there's a theorem, which says a Hamiltonian vector field vector field preserves symplectic structure, preserves symplectic structure. So what I mean by that is that the Lie derivative with respect to this vector field of omega equals to zero. So it's a symmetry of the symplectic structure. Okay? So any for any function f, this will be true. So now proof. And I told you that everything in mechanics is basically based on Cartan's lemma. So the proof is Cartan's lemma. So you have this beautiful identity that is equal to xf dot d of omega plus the other term d xf dot omega. So that's the Cartan's lemma. It tells you the Lie derivative is related to the exterior derivative of omega and then this thing here. That's how the Cartan's lemma look like. So now if you look at this thing here, so omega is closed. So d of omega is 0. So the first term is 0. Okay. So now xf acting on omega is minus df. That's what we shown here. So this guy is minus df. So this is equal to minus d squared of f. But of course, if you act twice with an exterior derivative of something, you get 0. So this is 0. Okay. So you've shown that really the Hamiltonian vector fields are nice. They leave. They don't change the omega. Okay. So consequence. It's precisely that Liouville's theorem, which I mentioned last lecture, is Liouville's theorem. I will write it in a slightly different way. So it was the deformation of the cat. So I told you that as you move in time or whatever, you deform the cat, but you don't change the volume of the cat. You squash it, but still Tibra wouldn't like it, but okay. So Liouville's theorem. So I'll write it a different way. So a Hamiltonian vector flow field, the Hamiltonian vector field preserves the volume element. Element on M. Okay. So if the volume element is preserved, if you integrate over that volume element, then actually it will remain the same no matter what you do under this flow. Okay. So now what the volume element is? So the statement is the volume element can be written as a product, wedge product of various omegas. So if you take omega is a two form. So now if you take omega wedge omega, you get a 4 form. If you get omega wedge omega wedge omega, you get a 6 form and so on. So in the end, you have to get, so the volume form is something which is the full rank thing. So it must have 2n, it must be a 2n form. So I have to take omega n times. Okay. And what you will see in a minute, well, maybe tomorrow, is that this is nothing else. Then if you choose the corresponding coordinates on the face on this thing, it will be dq1, wedge, dq2, wedge, dq3, wedge, whatever, and then also for piece. Okay, so it's the really, and so now if you remember how you integrate forms, is that you just change these things by forgetting what the wedge product is. So you will have an integral over dq1, dq2, dq3, dp1, dp. So it's precisely the volume integral. So this is a volume form, and it defines how we integrate on the phase space. Okay, so n times, so that's epsilon. And so the statement is that L x of f on epsilon equals to 0. But that's obvious, because we just shown that L x of f of omega equals to 0, and we can use the Leibniz rule. Okay, so if you use the Leibniz rule on this thing, you will differentiate this one, you get 0. Differentiate that one, you get 0. Differentiate that one, you get 0. So it's 0. So this is true. So the volume element does not change under the Hamiltonian vector flows. And if it doesn't, then the volume of the cat won't either. Okay, so now Poisson bracket. So the statement is, of course, we have to have two functions on the phase space. So two phase space functions. F and G. So then the small omega, if you want, or the capital omega, defines the Poisson bracket, defines a new scalar function. And you define it by this thing. You say F and G. And so you take dF, you take omega, and you take dG. So omega eats forms. So it eats in one slot dF, and in the other slot it eats dG, so the corresponding one forms. Or it's the same thing as minus omega. And so minus omega is a two form. So it eats vectors. So it eats the corresponding Hamiltonian vector flows generated by F and G. So that's the definition. Okay. And then you can show that all the properties of the Poisson brackets as we define them, so I don't know, antisymmetry, Jacobi identity, linearity, and so on, they follow from the properties of omega. So interesting one is, for example, the properties, so satisfies properties, I think it was 2 to 5, or I don't know, what were the numbers of Poisson brackets from before. So linearity, antisymmetry, everything is obvious. Antisymmetry comes from the antisymmetry of this guy. So if I flip the two, I pick up a minus sign, and so on. Interesting is the Jacobi identity. Interesting is Jacobi identity. And that can be related to the fact that d omega equals to 0. So if you are interested, try to show that as long as d omega equals to 0, as long as omega is closed, you will get a Jacobi identity for such defined Poisson bracket. You can do this. It's like three lines calculation. Okay, but all the other properties are basically automatically satisfied. Okay, so you can also play with these Poisson brackets, and you can get some interesting relations. And so one of them, let me just mention, so can also get other relations. And so an interesting one is that if you take a Poisson bracket of two functions, you get a new function, and you form the corresponding vector field, Hamiltonian vector field. And the statement is this is the same as if you take the vector field of F, the vector field of G, and form a Lie bracket out of them. So now you form a commutator of two vectors, you get a new vector, and it equals to that. So sometimes people use this as a definition of the Poisson bracket as well. Okay. So in my case, it's a consequence. Okay. So again, if you're interested, you can try to prove this. It's not that difficult, starting with this definition. Okay, so everything is so simple, right? Everything follows just from the existence of omega. and its properties. It's a two-form, it's closed, and it's non-degenerate. Okay? So now, of course, you would like to also show the property number one, so that's, which is that of the fundamental Poisson brackets, right? So you would like to show that Q with Q equals to 0, Q with P equals to 1, P with P equals to 0. Of course, for that, I need to choose the right coordinates on this manifold M. So I need to tell you what Q and what P is. Okay? And so there is this beautiful Darboux theorem. The theorem. And so it tells you, so in the same way as you can sort of write, so for example, this is known for the symmetric matrices. So for the symmetric matrices, you can always write a symmetric matrix as something which has on the diagonal its eigenvalues, and then some rotation matrices around it. Okay? So in the same way, and so you can choose the coordinates, but you basically only have the eigenvalues on the diagonal. Okay, so now for antisymmetric matrices, the same thing is true. It's a linear algebra. But now you don't have eigenvalues on the diagonal because you have to have antisymmetric matrix, so a diagonal is 0. But you can get a form where the eigenvalues are here, 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 and but with minus sign. Okay? So now if you have closed form, the eigenvalues are actually equal to 1. So Darboux theorem, so since omega is antisymmetric, symmetric, and closed, it has basically only eigenvalues plus minus 1, if you want, and non-degenerate, and non-degenerate, there exists a coordinate system on M, let's call it X alpha, and then I'll write it already so that we are ready for the classical mechanics. So I'll denote the first half, first n coordinates QI, and the second n coordinates PI. Okay, so x alpha, the coordinates on M, which is 2n dimensional. So there will be n of those, and there will be n of those. And so that the omega alpha beta, when written as a matrix, is precisely, so I will have diagonal, I will have blocks which are 2x2 blocks. I know that on the diagonal it has to be equal to 0 because it's an antisymmetric matrix. And the only eigenvalues are plus or minus 1. Or, well, the eigenvalues are I, but we can write it in this way. But it must be antisymmetric. So it's plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, and so on. And so you have n of these blocks. Okay, and everywhere else, it's equal to 0. And so what I mean by this thing is Q1, P1, Q1, P1, that will be Q2, P2, and so on. Okay, so I organize these things here. So it's really like diagonalization for symmetric matrices, but now we have antisymmetric matrix, so it's less familiar, but it's the same thing. So you have a diagonal where you pick up the eigenvalues, sort of, and the eigenvalues are like plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1. Okay, so in other words, you can write down the omega alpha beta as well. So omega alpha beta. So now it's an inverse. So in the inverse, just picks the minus, you know, in a different place. So it's exactly the same form, but now it'll be 0, minus 1, 1, 0, 1 block. The same thing here, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, and so on. And n blocks you would have. And so you can really, you know, construct these. It's a diagonalization process, basically. So in other words, if I'm confused here. So Q1, P1, Q1, P1, Q2, P2, and so on. So if you write it as a form, then the omega simply takes the form dp1 dq1 plus dp2 dq2 and so on. So it's dpi dqi. Okay? So that's the form omega takes. If you write it as a form, this is how it looks like as a matrix. Okay? So statement is that always you can always find such coordinates Q and P so that omega takes this very, very simple form. And it's a diagonalization process, basically. Okay. So now it is great. So a consequence of this, so consequence of these coordinates. Well, first consequence is that your epsilon, which I define as omega wedge omega n times, well, now you put it there and you play with the wedge product and you'll see that the only non-trivial term in the end has precisely the form dp1 wedge dq1 wedge dp2 wedge dq2 and so on. Dpn dqn. And so if you integrate over the omega of any function, so if you integrate over f, this is how you integrate forms. So it's just f of epsilon, which is just f of that form epsilon, but it's dp1 dq1, just the Lebesgue integral, dpn dqn. So this is indeed a volume form. It's preserved. So no matter which coordinates I'll choose, then it will always look like this. And so this is well defined, and so the cat remains the same. Okay, so this is very, very obvious in these coordinates why it looks like that. Finally, the Poisson bracket f and g, which I defined over somewhere here. So let me use that df dot omega dot dj, and let me write it in coordinates. So then you have d alpha of f omega alpha beta d beta on g. Okay, so that's precisely the first relation there. But now if you look at the special coordinates, omega alpha beta is just plus 1 or minus 1 for q1 and p1 and whatever. So this thing, if you think about it, is it only contributes if you know, it's 1 if you have q1 and p1. So this will be a derivative with respect to q, and this will be a derivative with respect to p, and this will be 1. And otherwise, it's 0. Okay? So this thing is omega alpha beta df over dx alpha dg over dx beta. But it only contributes because of this plus minus 1. And so it's written as df over dqi dg over dpi minus df over dpi dg over dqi. So in these coordinates, the Poisson bracket is defined here, takes the standard form as you know it. Okay. And moreover, if I just choose f and g to be q and p, you get the fundamental brackets back. Okay? So really, you can recover all the properties of the Poisson brackets from the definition. And the particular form only is taken in the special Darboux coordinates given by this Darboux theorem. Okay? So only in special coordinates, the Poisson bracket takes the Fermi form. It's the canonical Poisson bracket. In other coordinates, if you don't choose these coordinates, these Darboux bases, it will be more complicated, of course. But it's a completely invariant object. The Poisson bracket is something which does not depend on the coordinates. Right? That's obvious from the definition. It's a scalar function. OK. Questions?
Is
said the omega is two form, but it's equal to one form wedge one vector. So can you stay? Can you still say it?
Very good. No. So thanks for that question. Very good question. So remember, so my manifold is two-dimensional manifold. Okay. So here, the QI and PI are just coordinates on that manifold. Okay. So they are not. It's not a. So this I really enumerates which coordinate I mean. Right, it's the first one, Q1 or Q2 or whatever. So this I index is not a vector index. It just tells you, which coordinate I'm considering. Okay, so this thing is a scale function if you want. The coordinate is a scale function on the manifold. And so I'm taking D of that. So this is a form. And so it's the same thing here. This is a coordinate, taking D of that, it's a form. So this is actually a two form.
Where do the canonical transformations now enter?
Wait till tomorrow. Sorry, you still have to wait. But basically, the canonical transformations are such, you can define them in a way that if I choose these coordinates, the Darboux coordinates, so that the omega takes this particular form, then canonical transformations will be such that this is true. So that the omega takes exactly the same form.
But why do they become special? Because everything was invariant. The only special thing is that the Poisson bracket can be written in the canonical form.
Okay. So as you will see tomorrow.
Okay.
So this form of omega is particularly nice because this form of omega implies that your Hamilton's equations look simple. They just look dH over dP is Q dot and whatever. So now, if you change coordinates, of course, you can do that. But omega now will look more complicated. If omega looks more complicated, the resulting equations will look more complicated. They will sort of pick up some coordinate-dependent things.
Okay.
So it's something like the Newton's law is very nice. If you write it in an inertia frame, it's just F equals to ma, where F is the true force. Right? But if you write it in rotating frame or whatever, then you pick up a Coriolis force and you pick up some other mass.
Okay.
Right? So now you have not only true forces, but you have additional coordinate forces.
Yeah, okay. So they're
right?
Special in the sense that they give a good form to the...
Exactly. So they give the simplest possible form of the Hamilton's equation. If you can go beyond that, but then your Hamilton's equation is much more complicated.
So when you're going to apply this to the dynamical system and define the dynamical system, what you do is like you pick your manifold. And then you define your coordinates, and with your coordinates, you define your symplectic structure. That's the idea.
Define first the symplectic.
So your assumption is I have a two-dimensional manifold equipped with the symplectic structure.
And
so this symplectic structure determines preferred coordinates, if you want. And so that it takes a simple form in this coordinate.
Like in practice, you go the other way around, right?
So in practice, you don't do any of this. okay. Yeah. yeah. No, but the logic here is really I use my two form to define some nice coordinates. And so these nice coordinates, they are almost unique defined, except I can do canonical transformations on them. And so. If I do canonical transformations, I get new coordinates in which the symplectic structure still looks nice, but there's some restriction on this coordinate transformation.
But when you're going to define your dynamical system, you need to choose a form. How do you choose a form?
If you go to finite?
If you define your canonical system, your dynamical system, you need to choose a form, right?
Yeah, and I'll do that. Yes, I'll do that. So in practice, you could do that. So if you start with the true dynamical system, you're right. I could have Q and P, and then I'll define whatever my omega is are forming out of these Q and P, as long as these are canonical coordinates. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Other questions? OK. So tomorrow, we will apply this thing exactly to Hamiltonian mechanics. And yeah, we'll probably be doing what you are saying.